What is counseling and what does the counselor do? We discuss these topics with Dr. Bryce Hagedorn from the University of Central Florida. Dr. Hagedorn is a professor of counselor education at the UFC's College of Community Innovation and Education in Orlando, Florida. He came to Slovakia to help Trnava University run a new study program on counseling. In the podcast, you will listen to our discussion about counseling addicted families and a sequential assessment and treatment model Dr. Hagedorn co-authored. A simple start.
Yes.
What is counseling?
What is counseling? Counseling is a way of being with people, coming alongside them during life's challenges. And those challenges can range anything from I'm struggling with a teenager, right? So as a parent, how do I best help my teenager? To relationship difficulties between a marriage, all the way over into struggles with alcohol. And then in the United States, it goes all the way up into severe and persistent mental illness like schizophrenia, bipolar, depression. So the entire range, and counseling is a philosophy of helping that really sees the client as a collaborator, right? So rather than psychology oftentimes sees the person as a patient, right, who we use a medical approach to fix a disease, counseling sees the client who you collaborate with and you work together on a challenge.
So the client is not the object,
right,
per se, but more he or she is more subject or agent of the change.
Exactly. And so the work that a psychologist and a counselor actually does, very similar, not much difference in the United States or as we're starting the new profession in Slovakia. But our approach is very different. The way that we help is to help to empower the client, right, give them some ownership of their treatment so that they won't need to keep coming back, you know, years and years. Like, that's not the goal of counseling. The counseling is to empower, right, so that they learn the necessary skills that they can then use with other life challenges.
So it's like a school.
Yes.
School of life.
Yes, it is a school of life. That's a great way of saying it.
What's the difference between counseling and social work, for example?
So the difference between counseling and social work is that social work sees the client in context, right? So all the different things that are happening in society, and a social worker will come alongside someone and help them to navigate those various systems. So they might need family support or financial or behavioral or medical, right? And the social worker works with the person to find out all the things that they need. At least in America, social workers typically don't get into therapy. It's more of support, whereas the counselors and psychologists will go into therapy to go into their wound and their pain and their struggle.
As I've read in your bio, you are a licensed mental health counselor.
Correct.
What does it mean? How do you operate in such situations where there are some issues with mental health? Can you give us some example?
Sure. So depending on the setting in which I'm working, so I currently have a private practice,
okay,
that I do remotely, right? Mm-hmm. So I do it in Zoom. So that's what I'm doing now. In the past, I've worked in hospitals, and the mental health counselor will come alongside someone in their struggles, provide a diagnosis so they can use their insurance if they have insurance, put together a plan for treatment, and then help the person to obtain their goals for what they're attending counseling for. And again, that can be that they're in the hospital trying to stop alcohol or drug use, or they're in the hospital to receive medication for schizophrenia, right? The psychiatrist will prescribe the medication, But the counselor will work with the person to ensure they're taking the medication and also all the other things that they need to do to get healthy.
So as a counselor, you don't need to necessarily be in the family with the patient, but you can do it online.
Right, you can.
Or remote places.
Right, right. Yeah, and a lot of that is happening since the pandemic. A lot of places went to remote.
How does it look like in a, when you are talking and counseling?
This is, I think, another difference between counseling and psychology. The way that I'd say it is that a psychologist has been trained to treat a disorder. A counselor has been trained to treat an individual with a disorder, right? So a counselor spends a lot of time getting to know the client, all the different facets, different parts of who the person is, so that they can devise a plan to treat the way that they have a disorder. So rather than treating depression, I would need to learn everything about you, what's important to you, your belief system, your family background, your cultural aspect, you being a male, right? I need to know all that about you so I can treat your depression rather than just treating depression, because depression looks different on everybody. And then once I understand who you are and how you're experiencing your concerns, then we would put together a plan, and that was that would use the model we use is a holistic model. So we focus not just on the mind, but on the body, the spirit, and relationships. So a whole view of a person.
Excellent. And you can do that because you are a trained counselor.
Correct.
But you studied psychology, or what's your background?
My background is in counseling. So I started my bachelor's degree is in psychology. And then I was deciding, what do I do next? Actually, I was in the Marine Corps first. And then I got out and finished my degree. And then I kind of floated around and I took a couple courses in psychology and a couple courses in counseling. And the helping philosophy that I explained earlier, really from counseling, really resonated with me. Like, that's how I saw the way I wanted to help was to connect with the individual, not just the disorder. So then I found my way into master's of counseling and then my doctorate of counseling.
I believe that the U.S. is far many years ahead of Slovakia in terms of counseling education and counseling as such. And one of the reasons is that the counseling is covered by
insurance.
Mm-hmm. So people can get help thanks to their insurance. Am I right?
It is, and so we have two systems, right? We have the for-profit or insurance, and then we have the non-profit for those that can't afford insurance. And counselors are working in both, right? So the vast majority of counseling happens in community mental health, right? So those are the centers where people don't have to have insurance and can receive counseling. And unfortunately, the people that need that service are people that are that have the most struggles, right? Because they can't maintain a job, or because how severe their mental illness is, or they can't stay in a home, right? So sometimes they're living on the street, sometimes they're floating from place to place, and so they're usually very ill, and they need the type of help that a counselor, a psychologist, and a social worker, everybody working together to help that person have a productive life.
You're also a master addiction counselor.
Yes.
Maybe we can elaborate on it more. How addictions affect people, affect their families, and what can a counselor do?
Right. So my philosophy about why does addiction happen comes from the author Henry Nouwen. He said that people were born to experience perfect love, but then they encounter imperfect people. So that might be their parents, right?
But there are some assumptions.
Oh, yeah. There are some excellent parents, right? But no perfect parents, right? And so for those that experience imperfect people and then a wound develops, all right? So their heart gets broken in some way. they develop various coping mechanisms, right? And alcohol is a great coping mechanism because it helps to numb and push away the pain, right? But then those coping mechanisms get out of control, and then it's those very same coping mechanisms that interfere with their experience of perfect love. So alcohol, drugs, sex, gambling, food, social media, internet, right? These are all different coping mechanisms, right? And when people realize that they can use something to cope with life, if they become more dependent on the coping mechanism than any other aspect, then it turns into addiction, right? And then that becomes their main way of dealing with life.
And how can you help in such situation, you as a counselor? What can you do?
So one is to bring awareness, mm-hmm. right, to the person that their coping mechanism is there for a reason. So let's figure out what is the reason. You know, why is it that you keep turning to drug or alcohol or gambling as a way to cope? So we want to identify what is the wound, but not go there too soon. So we want to first help them to develop other ways of coping. So addiction is a very individual, I even call it a selfish illness, because I'm doing what I think is best for me, right? And so I need to get out of my way of doing things and get into a community.
So, is that possible?
Yeah, so a community could either be a treatment community or a support group. So we have lots of support groups that clients can choose from, like Alcoholics Anonymous is a big support group. Yes. And people can go there for free, right? Receive support and realize that I don't need to be doing it just for me. I need support from other people. So we want to help them to find support, develop other ways of coping that are healthier, and then we can go back to what is the reason you use in the first place. So the first part of treatment is coping and community, and then we go to the core wound. So those are the C's, coping, community, core.
Three C's. As far as I know and understand, addicted people, they are quite reluctant to change.
Yes, until they have a good enough reason to change. Right.
What are the good reasons?
Well, people won't change until they've had enough pain or they have found enough inspiration. So we either need to let them have enough pain, and a counselor can be there and see their pain and just acknowledge, are you ready to change yet? And maybe you're not. I don't want to force it, because forcing it doesn't work long term. Like, you can force someone's behavior for short term, right? But over the long term, you can't. And another thing would be to provide some inspiration. So that's why attending those support groups can be so powerful, because they hear people who are years and years into recovery, and they can be inspired by their story. They, oh, that person did it. I can do it. Let me talk to them and find out how they, and the more people they find to inspire them, their reluctance goes down, and then they're ready to receive help.
So as a counselor, you also try to connect them with those support groups?
Yes, right. And that's and that really is key, because I never try and do care for someone just me. Like, I don't want to be someone's only support, right? Because then that can foster codependency, right? Like,
yeah, which is also a bad thing.
Right. So I don't want to be someone's only supportive person. I want to try and find other people so we can use a whole team approach, so that if I'm not available, they can call, you know.
What are healthier coping mechanisms than addiction?
So I have a model, I call it the five F's, all right? So faith, mm-hmm. family, friends, fitness, and fun.
Fun.
So part of my getting to know who the person is what is your belief system? You know, and maybe they don't have a religious belief system, but they have a personal philosophy or a worldview that brings them comfort. Who do they consider to be family? You know, maybe it's their actual family, or maybe it's really close friends. Spending time with friends, finding something that involves exercise, nutrition, right? But something that's fun. So trying to find other coping mechanisms are usually in those five areas. And it takes some time because people may have tried different things. Like, not everybody wants to exercise, right? But maybe they enjoy taking a walk in nature, but they don't consider that actually, like, that's not exercise. Sure, that's exercise. And then helping people to rediscover their belief system, to rediscover their faith maybe they had as a child, and see what that is going to be like as an adult, because it has changed, right? Particularly if they've pushed it away in the midst of their other coping mechanisms, their addictions.
When I talk to people about problems, troubles, addictions, and stuff like that, we usually agree that that the beginning of the problem starts within the family. Do you agree?
I certainly agree. So I have a book called Counseling Addicted Families, and that is all about using a family system approach. So unfortunately, in the United States, we really only treat individuals because of insurance, right? Insurance, you need a medical diagnosis for a person, not for a family. So insurance doesn't pay for family counseling or couples counseling. They only pay for individual counseling. So if someone's going to get family or couples counseling, they have to have enough money to do that, which is one of the broken parts of our system, you know, insurance system. But to be really effective, you can't just treat the individual because it's the whole family system, right? So if there's someone that struggles with addiction in a family, say it's four people, and one of them struggles with addiction, they all struggle with addiction, right? Because they're all changing how they act and how they feel when they're around that person. But if you only treat the individual, which happens, you know, we take them out of the family, we treat them in, you know, 2, 3, 4 months, put them back in the system, and nothing has changed in the system, they're eventually going to be pulled back into their old role of the addict because everybody else is still playing their role. So you really have to treat the whole family, but it's the challenge again. So the nice thing is that there are support groups for family, right? So just like there's Alcoholics Anonymous, there's also a group called Al-Anon. And Al-Anon is a support group for friends and family of alcoholics. So only the family attends here, and then the alcoholic can attend AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the same thing with drugs. There's two groups. Sexual addiction, two groups. Gambling, two groups. So there's a lot of support groups that are available, but the family needs their own support.
If I'm hearing you correctly, not only the addicted person needs to change, but also their family members need change.
Right, which is a difficult pill to swallow for the family, because they think, like, why do we need to change? It's his problem or her problem, right? But over time, we've all adjusted to the alcoholic or the addict's behaviors, right? And so I just need to change how I am used to dealing with them, right? And focus on me, because in a family, we're always focused on the person with the addiction. Right, we're always adjusting how we are acting and what we're saying and how we're feeling. And so we have to change that focus from the alcoholic or the addict and realize I need to be a better version of myself that isn't dependent on the alcoholic. And that's where that term codependent comes from, because the dependent is someone who is dependent on alcohol, drugs, sex, gambling. The codependent is someone who's dependent on that person to define how I feel or how I think. So I need to rediscover who I am.
And to break down the codependency.
Right. To break that. But again, it's very difficult because in codependency, you think that you're doing what's best for them, but you're actually perpetuating their illness, because part of their illness is to take, and never give back, right? And a codependent gives, but never gives anything to themselves. So it feels very selfish when you break codependency to learn, what are my needs? What are my feelings separate from the dependent? You know, the family can still stay together, but each person needs to learn what's important to them. The alcoholic and addict needs to learn new ways of coping with life. The codependent needs to learn new ways of coping with life that doesn't involve always meeting the addict's needs.
You already mentioned your book, titled Counseling Addicted Families.
Yes.
The book describes a sequential family addictions model.
Yes.
Long story short, but what is it?
There is a, it's called a model of change. It's called the trans-theoretical model of change, which means it's not governed by one theory. It's a theory on top of other theories. Or maybe it's underneath. Either way. So trans theory means you don't have to stay with one theory. So our idea with the book, and we've been using this model for like 20 years, my co-author and I, it takes those stages of change that people go through. So when you're considering stopping smoking, right? Like, I think I need to stop smoking, or I think I need to go on a diet. The first stage is called pre-contemplation, where you don't think you have a problem, but everybody else can see it, but you don't see it. You don't want to see it, all right? So then the next stage would be contemplation. Oh, I have a problem, but you're not really doing anything about it. You're thinking about it. And I would say everybody in the world is in contemplation about something. We all know there's something that we probably should be doing differently, and we've been thinking about it. Maybe we've tried and it just hasn't worked, so we just think about it. Planning is next, putting together a plan for making a change. Action is making the change. Maintenance is continuing the change. And then termination is where you no longer have to think about it. Like, things have changed, all right? So that's that stages of change. And then the sequential model takes different psychological theories and approaches and attaches them to each stage of change, right? So what works in pre-contemplation, what works in et cetera, et cetera. So that's the book talks about how to do each of those theories with a couple or a family as they go through their change process.
So the final stage is the termination.
Termination, right.
Which means that the problems terminate.
Say let's go back to smoking, right? So someone could have been a long-time smoker, right? But then at some point when they're no longer smoking, they don't want a cigarette anymore, right? In maintenance, every so often they'll walk by someone smoking and they'll go, oh, I remember that.
Right?
I would love to smoke, but I'm not going to because I've already changed. Mm-hmm. But there's still like a desire, mm-hmm. right? Then later on, they can walk by a smoker and not have any desire. Like, ugh, you know, they're like, that smells horrible. Right?
I would love to be in that final stage.
Would you? Okay, yeah. So, I mean, and like no more temptation. You don't think about what you're missing. You're just really liking not being a smoker.
It looks like heaven.
Yes, it looks like heaven. In termination, you can take what you learned about change. And the next thing you need to change, you use that same skill set and go through the process again.
Yeah. It's learning by teaching. It's
yes.
Maybe teaching by learning.
Right. And unfortunately, people go from contemplation, thinking about it, to action, doing about it. But they don't have a good plan. So then they relapse, right? So like, no smoking, I'm stopping, right? And then next day, good. 1 week later, just one cigarette. And then they relapse and they go back like, oh, I'm never going to change. Why even try? And then they go back into pre-contemplation. I don't have a problem.
Do you practice these sequential family addictions model in your practice?
Very much so, okay. Yes. Yeah, and it's not just for families. So that's the way my treatment approach is sequential, meaning I use those theories and those approaches in a very orderly way, right? I don't always have to start at the beginning because not everybody is in pre-contemplation, right? Sometimes they're just ready to make a plan. So that's where I'll start. But in my getting to know the client, the couple, the family, in my initial meetings, I'm asking questions, I'm using assessments to find out where are they as it relates to their problem. And once I recognize that, and then I can use the approach that fits them, you know. So that's why like one treatment approach, like I know in Slovakia, a lot of people use like a psychoanalytic approach, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Particularly as a psychologist. But psychoanalysis doesn't, and people are gonna curse me for saying this, but it doesn't work for everybody because not everybody's ready to do that type of intensive psychotherapy. So I think a sequential approach better meets the needs, because you find out where the person is in their struggle and then meet them right there and then move them forward.
Counseling is a new study program
Yes.
at Trnava University, but also a kind of new approach
Right.
of helping people, I would put it that way. You are a fellow of the American Counseling Association. How big is counseling in the U.S.?
It is equal to social work and psychology. So those are the three main approaches to working with clients and patients. So it is it's the newest of the three, and it's the youngest of the three. So psychology and social work have been around much longer. So same thing like in Slovakia, right? We have psychology and social work, and counseling is just starting. Counseling in the United States started around 1956, so it's still fairly new. And we're kind of at the end of defining who are we and how are we different from the other helping professions. And those are some of the things I talked about, that holistic view of a person, our approach, all those things are. But the American Counseling Association is our professional association. And then to be considered a fellow is the highest recognition you can have in counseling. So that's something that is nominated by the association and then voted on by the association. So,
back to the history, what was the motivation for such a new approach? Why psychology or social work weren't working enough or well,
right,
that the Americans back to 50s
right
needed something new, something else?
Yeah, so I mean, 56 and then into the 60s and 70s is where it really grabbed hold. We were missing the individual, right? We're just seeing them as a patient, as an agent to act upon,
okay,
right? And we realized that, particularly with managed care and insurance, we don't have years and years of therapy that psychology had typically done, right? And also, only those who could afford psychology for years and years and years could receive help, right? So the community mental health model, having free or affordable services, we needed a new approach, right? And we recognized, particularly with the spread of the humanistic movement, right, of the 60s and 70s, and seeing how important the individual is, that helped to shape our different approach to how we work with people. We need to see the person behind the illness and not just, you know, call them their illness. You know, it's interesting, in mental health services, it's the only diagnosis that we refer to someone as their diagnosis, right? So for example, if you struggle with anxiety, you know, we would say you are anxious, right? But if you have heart disease, we don't say you are heart disease, right? So it's only in mental health that, and this is a part that we need to change, we refer to people as their diagnoses, not as their humanity. But in all other medical, you know, we refer to them as a person with heart disease or a person with diabetes, right? So we try and change the language of someone with alcoholism or someone who struggles with schizophrenia, but they are not schizophrenia. So
you serve as a professor and program director of counselor education at the University of Central Florida. I've read on your website that the counselors are to make positive, healthy changes in individual lives.
Mm.
You've said that you are like more than 20 years in the education,
mm-hmm,
at least.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the change?
I do see change. I see that we are becoming much more focused on multiculturalism and diversity. Another thing that we've been really good at is how do we hold on to our values and our beliefs while working with someone that has different values or different beliefs, right? That the counseling session is not for convincing or converting, it's for conversation, right? And the conversation can be healing and redemptive, right? As long as I can hold those two things in the same space, My values, my beliefs, my morals are very important to me, and so are yours. And how can we work together, even though they might be very different, and if we were to talk about them, maybe even clash? But this is not the place to necessarily, I'm not going to talk about my values with my client. I want to understand their perspective and then help them to use that to help move towards healing, right? I could try and change their values, but then I'm just one more voice that's telling them that they're not valuable, that they're not important, that they don't have what it takes. And I want them to hear their voice in their head saying, I do have value. I do have what it takes. I can be involved in my care, right? Because that's the voice they will continue to hear. They don't need one more voice telling them how to live their lives. So that's something that the counseling has been very involved with. Also, again, that holistic view, a wellness view versus an illness view is another thing. In our programs, so we have we have three master's degree and one doctoral degree. So we have
just in counseling.
So we have the clinical mental health, which is my background. We have school counseling. Mm-hmm. We have marriage and family therapy, and then we have a doctorate. So people that want to become professors and researchers are in the doctorate.
I've read many news in Slovakia about the growth of mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read those news mainly after the pandemic. What is the trend in US or maybe in Florida where you live? I would put it that way. I would put it differently. Do you have more clients as a counselor, for example, after the pandemic? Where are people standing now? Do they have more troubles, more issues than they had a few years before?
I think so. I think the new pandemic is loneliness. And so I think that the global pandemic around COVID really helped to bring that out about how disconnected we are. And even though we have social media, we have different ways of technology that join us all together, we're still very much alone. And when we had to be alone, that's when all the problems came up to the surface. I don't know if I necessarily have more clients. I think the severity of their concerns has increased. Just because they've realized that even though we've gotten back together and we're face to face now, that loneliness was shown to me, right? Like I couldn't avoid how alone I am. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being sad or being anxious or being depressed. I think it makes it worse when you're depressed alone or anxious alone or struggling with addiction and alone, right? So that whole sense of like loneliness is something that we're trying to make an impact on.
They even say that the loneliness is worse for health than smoking.
Right, right. Yeah, you can lose more years of life, right, yeah, being alone than you can related to smoking. You're right.
And as a counselor, can you help people deal with loneliness?
We can, and again, part of it is to recognize what role can they take in their loneliness, right? So is it just to sit in their misery? So when I can witness and acknowledge that someone is alone, right? And how, so a big question I ask my clients is, what role can I serve to help you, right? So sometimes they just need accountability. They need someone to check in with each week to make sure that they are doing what they said they wanted to do. Right. Sometimes it's about helping them to recognize what gets in the way. Right. So do they have social anxiety and where does that come from? Maybe we dig into that. Maybe they don't have the skills to connect. Right. So whenever they try and engage other people, maybe there's something about them that is off-putting that maybe they can change. Right. So, even just looking at how they present in social settings. And we can try different things in counseling. So we can do a enactment where you can lead me through what happened in the job interview. Let's role play. And then I can give feedback about what they could have done differently or how they could have sat. So yeah, there's a lot of things you can do. And then again, helping to connect them with the community. So finding other people, hobbies, where can the person connect? But oftentimes it's around accountability. So someone that will walk with you as you're trying to break out of your loneliness.
Your expertise lies also in the integration of spirituality and counseling.
Correct.
I can see the integration, but for our listeners, can those two things be integrated and how?
Particularly for that holistic view of the person, it would be like saying, I can be healthy psychologically, but not have my physical health. Those are integrated, right? So how my body is operating and how my mind is operating are linked directly, right? Same thing with how my mind is operating and how my relationships are operating, right? So if my marriage is not good, then that's going to affect my mind, right? And how my mind is operating is going to affect my marriage, right? So if I'm struggling with depression, it's going to affect my wife. If my wife and I are not getting along, it will affect my depression, right? Sure. So same way with my spirituality, my religion, my belief systems, those are integrated and really have to be.
Does everyone have spirituality?
Does everyone have spirituality? Using my lens, I would say yes, but I want to use my client's lens. But again, it's not my job to convince them, right?
I'm just curious.
But if you broaden the definition of spirituality to being what brings you personal meaning and what guides your life, all right? So that can be your own personal philosophy, right? You can be your own moral code of what you think is right and wrong for how people, or how you operate, right? How you approach life. It can be your worldview, you know, kind of where do you fit in finding meaning to your life? So being an agnostic, being atheist, that's a belief system, right? I don't believe in a being for an atheist. I don't believe in a higher power or agnostic. I believe that there's something, but I don't want to call it God, right? But that's still a way of organizing how I bring meaning into my life, right? And so regardless of where someone is, I want to help them to discover where are they in making meaning of their mental health concerns. Are there things we can grab from that meaning making to help you, right? Or is part of your struggle, your mental health struggle, coming from a fact that you don't have anything to hold on to? And maybe that's what I can help the client to do, is to find their meaning, right? To rediscover spirituality or a belief system or the role that religion will play, right? And I can provide the space for them to really critically examine it without feeling concerned that I'm going to try and convince them you need to be spiritual, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because that's going to push them back.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, they don't need that. They need a place where they can openly discuss their ideas, their struggles, their beliefs, their unbeliefs, in a place where they feel supported and honored, and someone's not trying to make them change. So
the spirituality is about meaning.
Correct.
It's one of the things.
Yeah, at its largest place.
Yeah.
How do I make meaning?
I've met people who lacked a sense of meaning, sense of their meaning of life,
right,
of their life. Can it relate to maybe the lack of spirituality, that their spirituality doesn't explain their meaning of life?
Right. And I think in the people that you've met that have lacked meaning and don't have a purpose, they tend to be not the most joyful people. They tend to be pretty cynical.
They have coping mechanisms.
Yeah, they have. That's true. They have other ways of coping, and maybe that gives them meaning, right? Except those coping mechanisms are probably hurting themselves or other people, right? I think a big part of it is to help them to recognize that the reason that those coping mechanisms are so harmful is because they don't have anything else to hold on to. And so that would be my attempt to help would be to help them to recognize there's something better. They don't know what that is, or they don't know what they've been, they don't want what they were taught earlier, right? Like, I don't want that, but I don't know what else to go to. So the place that a counselor can step in is to, let's look at this together. Let's re-examine some of those foundations or some of those beliefs. And I have a very strong belief system myself, so I know what brings me purpose and meaning, right? And so I believe that since I know what that is, I can give you space to discover what yours is. I don't have to impose my values, but my values do guide how I help, right? And my values and my beliefs talk about grace and talk about compassion and talk about respect and love, right? And so from that place, I can offer those things to someone. And when someone experiences that in a counseling setting, it becomes a curative factor, right? They get to have a space where they can feel honored and loved and cared for and experience grace, unmerited favor, or in psychology or counseling, we call it unconditional positive regard, right? And those are all mechanisms of connection, and then the connection leads to healing.
You came to Slovakia for a conference.
Yes.
To speak on motivational interviewing.
Yes.
What is it?
So motivational interviewing, when I was describing the sequential model, okay, in pre-contemplation, that first stage where someone doesn't think they have a problem, traditional therapies don't work there, right? Because if the person doesn't think they have a problem, then their only reason they're in a therapist's office is because someone convinced them or pushed them, like, you need help. But they don't think they need help. They just want people to get off their back, all right? So motivational interviewing is a relatively new style of counseling where its main focus is to work with resistance and to change it from resistance, I don't have a problem, into ambivalence, I have a problem, but I don't want to change. That's ambivalence, right? To finally tipping the scales into, I think I need to change, all right? So motivational interviewing is a way of connecting with people. There are different techniques that you use to reorganize how people are talking about themselves. It's based on this theory called self-perception theory, which means you come to believe what you hear yourself saying, right? So the way that I would reflect your feelings or when you're talking about your story and I'm giving your story back, the way that I organize that is so that you start hearing yourself saying, I don't like my current situation. I don't say that, I get you to say that. So there's an ethical component about motivational interviewing, because when I was first learning it, I could win any argument because I became very good at using your words and turning them around so that you came up with my idea. Right. So it's a very methodical way of changing how. So you have to use it practically and ethically. And then spiritual bypass, right, is a way of using religion, primarily religion, as a way of avoiding recognizing that I have a pain. All right. So people that are in pre-contemplation, I don't have a problem. God's going to take care of it. So it's another layer of denial. Right. I don't want to admit that I have an alcohol problem because that would mean I'm not a good follower of God. So I'm just going to deny that I have an alcohol problem. Jink, 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 right? But God's going to remove it from me, or maybe this is what God wants for me, right? Or I'm waiting for a miracle and then I'll change. So it's a way of deferring responsibility. I don't have to do anything because God's going to do it. So that's what spiritual bypass is, that they are using spiritual content or language to bypass psychological pain or discomfort so they don't have to look at it.
Actually, that's a very good topic for a short question. Mm-hmm. Because mainly in Christianity, I don't know, I'm not familiar with other religions, mm-hmm. but maybe also others do have a sense of suffering, sense of pain, that we need to sacrifice something for something else, something
right.
different. But also I'm meeting people who are believers,
mm-hmm.
And I would say that they do the same thing you just described, that they're waiting for miracle or just sacrificing their psychological pain for some higher purpose.
Right.
But obviously they need help.
Mm.
They need counselor.
Right.
Maybe.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. how do you help them to overcome this view that still they are believers? God is for them, but still they need the help from outside. Meaning when we have, I don't know, when someone has broken leg,
mm-hmm.
we don't say to them that, okay, just pray, just suffer.
Right.
We give them help.
Right, right. Help. Yeah, I think, so how to help is to first, and I know I said this before, is to first really understand the person and understand their belief system. Because sometimes people believe things that aren't necessarily connected to the foundations of their faith, right? So they have learned over time, either from family or from religious leaders, or the way they understood a religious leader is not accurate, right? So part of it is, again, understanding who they are, what their beliefs are, how their beliefs influence their lives. And then let's look at those influences. Let's look at their religious texts. Let's look at where they're getting those messages and explore it together, right? So, you know, you talk about suffering. I think another thing I see in the Christian tradition is that we're always supposed to be filled with joy and happy, right?
It's impossible.
Right. But maybe I'm not being a good Christian if I don't have a smile on my face at Mass, right? And when we come to Mass, when we come to church, everybody looks like they have it all together. Everybody looks so nice and clean. How are you? Blessed. I am so blessed. God is so good, right? But then I go home and I beat my wife, right? But I don't talk about that, right? Because in church, or she won't talk about that, because in church, we're all supposed to look our best, right? We go there to perform because we think we're supposed to be filled with joy and filled with happiness, right? But then our behaviors don't match. So one would provide a space for, let's talk about what's really going on, right? Let's talk about where does that belief come from that we all have to be happy, right? Let's look into the religious texts. Do we see a lot of happy people in the Bible? Or do we see a lot of people who struggled, right? Who like fell on their faces and then God restored them. And then they fell on their faces again, and God restored them. But the Christian tradition is struggle and finding God's role and my role, right? So let's look into the book of James and talks about faith without works is dead. So that means I do want to wait on God's part, but I also need to do my part, right? So again, but I'd have to understand someone's beliefs and where they come from, where are those origins. And then let's look at it critically together. I'm not going to try and preach at you, but I'm going to use your beliefs to look at your foundations and see, is that working for you? And if it is working for you, why are you coming to see me? So obviously something's not working, right? So let's see, is there a different way of doing that? Is there a different way of interpreting that or applying that to your life? But I want to provide the space for us to look at that and someone doesn't feel threatened. Right, because they may think that coming into a counselor that I'm going to preach at them. You have to be a better Christian, and that's what they're already struggling with, that they can't be a better Christian. So,
understood. You have been married for more than 25 years.
Yes, we just celebrated 26.
26.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It takes a lot of work.
In the beginning of this interview, you were quoting quote about imperfect love.
Yes.
So maybe you are an imperfect lover.
Oh, no. We are totally imperfect.
Do you have any advice for couples, for marriages, married couples, on how to still love each other after such a long time?
Yes. I think that the longer a couple is together, the less that they invest in one another and in the marriage, right? They get comfortable in their routine, right? But people change, but sometimes the couple doesn't, right? So that's why, you know, years into a marriage, there can be struggle or disconnection. Or like when the children, if there are children, when they leave the home and it's just the husband and wife together, they don't know who they are together. And this is something that my wife and I are experiencing, right? But we have been investing in our relationship all along. And we've definitely had our bumps and our bruises and our pain, right? But we've gone to therapy ourselves. You know? And I totally believe that every therapist should have a therapist. Okay? Because every story that I hear from a client becomes part of my story. Even if I'm really good at professional distance, but if I listen to painful stories all day long, when I get home, all I have to give her is eight people's pain, right? Because that's what's in my head and my heart. So one, I need to do my own work so that when I come home, I can give her the love and care that she needs, right? So going to a marriage and family therapist, we have done that on several occasions. We have been a part of and led marriage ministry in our church, right? So investing in new couples, right? So doing marriage preparation. Mm-hmm. So our church had a 13-week marriage preparation course for anybody that wanted to get married.
And it's still not enough.
And it's still not enough. Then we also started, helped a marriage enrichment class. So this would be a class where couples could come at different parts of their life to reinvest, to relearn some of those things that they knew when they were young couples and thought that everything was going to be easy peasy, right? And they get to reinvest. And then there are also what are called marriage encounter weekends. So you can go away for a weekend and in a program or a class and reinvest. But so we have date nights every week. We go to church together. We serve together. We have our weekly walks. We go for a walk and then eat breakfast every Saturday morning. So we have the thing that we continue to pour into each other.
So continue to invest in your relationship.
Yeah, just like you would invest in your finances. You can't just expect when you comes to retirement age, if you haven't invested, that you're going to have enough money to live on. And you invest in your kids and hope that they will turn into productive adults. You can't control that. But I want to invest in my marriage so that, continually invest, so that I will have what I want as we move forward.
I hope you have some spare time.
Oh, yes, yes.
And if your bio is correct, you enjoy obstacle course racing and backpacking.
Yes.
Do you?
I do. In fact, when I get back to the United States, myself and my group of men, so I very much believe in having a band of brothers. So for me, I have about five or six men that I know that I can depend on and they can depend on me. And we can be honest with each other and have fun with each other. So one of the things every year is we go out for 1 week and we go backpacking along the Appalachian Trail. And that goes from Georgia to Maine. And it's like 2,200 miles, which is like 4,000 kilometers.
2,200
miles?
Yeah. Yeah, it could be almost 400 kilometers.
Yeah. So we've been doing it in 1 week segments. Mm-hmm. So we strap on our backpacks, bring our food and everything, and we just go out for a week. So I'm doing that November 9th through like the 16th.
And we're going out. Coming weeks, you are going for the Appalachian Trail.
So I do that every year.
What does it bring to you?
Both a connection with God, because we're out in nature, no distractions, no phones, right?
No food.
We do have food, but we also have to find our water, right? Because you can only carry so much water. So you have to, you're always looking for your next water source. So that makes you dependent on God, on nature to provide what you need. So it changes how you think. Gets me in deep connection with these men. So that's our time, again, no distractions, and we can just talk about everything. So everything from our marriages to our understandings of God to making fun of each other's mothers, like men do, right?
We always do
that, always teasing each other, right? laughing at lots of laughter. Sometimes someone is really struggling in their marriage, and this is a place for us to talk about that.
So it's quite a friend circle for you.
Very much so. And it's a
comfortable.
Yeah, and it recenters me. It gets me back to what's most important. And then the obstacle course races, that's kind of like going back to boot camp when I was in the Marine Corps. So ropes and things you jump over, you crawl under, and you're like running through the woods, and they have different obstacles, different things that you have to get over. So like monkey bars.
Does it keep you fit?
It does, yeah.
So you do it for the way of, for that reason.
Yeah. And I part of my daily exercise is I usually work out for about an hour a day. And I really enjoy that type of exercise, kind of like the high intensity intervals. That's what I love doing.
Cool. Last question.
Yeah.
Are there in the world any obstacles that one can't overcome?
That can't overcome? Wow. It's like you do this professionally. That was a great question.
You too.
I think there are certain challenges that will never be finished with. Mm-hmm. Right? So the fact that a traumatic event happened. So, for example, in the Marine Corps, I was in combat, right? That happened. That's never going to be done in my mind. So what I did when I was in combat resulted in horrible things happen in war, right? So that's never going to go away. And for some, that becomes their main focus for the rest of their life. Like they can't get past it. But I have found with counseling, with my faith, with my family, I've changed how I live with it, right? So it doesn't go away, but how much I let it influence my day-to-day, it doesn't influence my day-to-day anymore. It's not in termination, okay? Because it's always going to be there. It's in maintenance. And maintenance can be anywhere from 6 months to a lifetime. That's just something I'm going to need to learn to live with, right? So trauma never goes away, but I don't have to be carrying it around with me everywhere I go. It doesn't have to be the screen through which I interpret my life events. It doesn't have to be through trauma, right? So I don't think there are any problems. I don't think problems ever go away. I just think we learn better coping, right? And then those coping then bring us new connections, new meaning, right? And that helps us to connect with the perfect love, whether that be from a higher power, whether that be from the people around us. So I think that's the better approach. And I also wanted to say one more thing about counseling in Slovakia. I think this is true in America too, but definitely here as the profession blossoms. Not everybody needs a psychologist in Slovakia, but everybody needs a counselor because we all have life challenges. And it would be wonderful to have a neutral person to walk with us as we navigate our normal life challenges. It doesn't have to be where I have a mental illness. I might, but I just am the normal day-to-day struggles in my family, struggles at my job, struggles with my faith, struggles with my health, right? Where a counselor would be a crucial person to have in my corner.
Great talking to you. And thank you very much for having you here on our podcast.
It's been a pleasure.